From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump kicked off the NATO summit in Brussels today with some harsh words for U.S. allies. Speaking to NATO's Secretary General, Trump accused Germany of being beholden to Russia because of a natural gas pipeline it wants built between the two nations.
Ultimately, Germany will have almost 70% of their country controlled by Russia with natural gas. So you tell me, is that appropriate? I mean, I've been complaining about this from the time I got in. It should have never been allowed to have happened. But Germany is totally controlled by Russia.
Joining us now is John Hanna, former senior advisor to President Bill Clinton, Secretary of State, and former national security advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney. He's now with the Foundation for Defensive Democracies. John Hanna, German officials have disputed Trump's claim that they're captive to Russia because of oil and gas. What do you think?
Well, I think on the merits, the question about the pipeline from Russia to Germany, Germany's dependence on Russia for its energy security is a real problem, and real differences exist over that issue that I think are valid and worthy of discussion. But the notion that Germany writ large is somehow beholden or captive to Russia, I just think is completely false. In fact, Chancellor Merkel and Germany have been the bedrock of the sanctions that NATO and Europe have imposed on Russia since the invasion of Crimea, and it's come at quite a high economic price to Germany. So I think the charge is really quite unfair.
After those comments were made, President Trump and Chancellor Merkel appeared before reporters, and Trump took a more conciliatory tone. He said that the two leaders have a very, very good relationship. Do you believe that?
No, I don't think you can put lipstick on this pig at this point in time. We've just had too much evidence that the president's deep level of resentment, apparently, for the alliance, for our European transatlantic partners, is just quite deep for him. And I think Germany and Chancellor Merkel herself personally sit at the top of that totem pole.
Well, what do you think of the president pushing NATO countries to spend 2% of their GDP on defense, which most of them don't do at this point? Now, they never made a promise that they would right now. They said they'd do it by 2024. But he's saying, you know, let's do it now if this is so important to you.
Again, it's one of those things that on the discrete issue itself, I think there's real merits. And President Trump's predecessors very much had this idea of greater burden sharing by our European partners. On the other hand, I really do think it's something that deserves some degree of nuance. It needs to be treated as a scalpel, not as an axe, because every defense dollar isn't equal. Greece is one of those countries that actually spends right over 2% of its economy. And yet, if you can find a Greek soldier in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria serving alongside the United States, I'd love to hear about it. Denmark, in contrast, which spends less than 2% of its economy on defense, has been right in the thick of every single one of those conflicts, losing soldiers alongside American troops. So I do think it deserves some nuance, and it does have to be placed in context. You cannot batter this defense issue in a way that actually puts into play the actual utility and importance of the alliance to American national security policy. That issue cannot get lost.
Well, and Greece presumably spending that money because of its rivalry with Turkey, also a NATO member.
Exactly.
What do you think will happen if Trump doesn't get what he wants out of NATO countries?
It's unclear. I mean, the continuing battering away at the alliance, almost a campaign to convince the American people that that our involvement in the alliance is just not worth it. I don't think it can actually lead to the dissolution of NATO, at least not in any immediate time frame. Too many people in the United States as well as in Europe just have too much invested in the importance of the alliance. But I do think it begins to hollow it out, and it does detract from the main purpose of the alliance, which is to deter threats against the transatlantic members, to keep the peace in Europe. And when that begins to come into question, when the main centerpiece of NATO, the United States, begins to question first principles about collective defense, that's when you're actually inviting challenges to the alliance, at least along its margins in places like the Baltics.
That's John Hanna, who is a former senior advisor to the Secretary of State during the Bill Clinton administration and former national security advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney, now a senior counselor at the Foundation for Defensive Democracies. John Hanna, thank you for joining us.
A pleasure, Jeremy.
Well, the Dow dropped more than 180 points earlier today, right after the Trump administration announced new tariffs on an additional $200 billion worth of Chinese goods. Trade Rep Robert Lighthizer released the list. In a couple of months, it'll cost the Chinese more to send everything from fish to baseball gloves to dog leashes to U.S. consumers, who probably help pay for those tariffs. Claire Sebastian is a correspondent for CNN Money. She joins us from New York. Claire, what do you make of the market reaction earlier today to these tariffs?
Well, Robin, it was actually fairly modest. We've seen that trade is a headline that really has been playing out on Wall Street over the past couple of months. I've spent a lot of time down at the stock exchange talking to traders, and this is something that can really get them worried. We've seen, even in the course of one day, the market's moving up and down based on comments and actions from the administration. So this was a fairly muted reaction. I think the reason for that is that this isn't a week where we're seeing strong fundamentals in the economy backed up by a strong jobs report on Friday, and we're heading into earnings season, which many are expecting to be really strong. So this is the traditional stock market fare. They're trading on the economy and on corporate earnings. And I think because this is just a list so far, it hasn't actually come into force, and there's still going to be a comment period. They're just kind of treading water on this a little bit today.
Well, and why these tariffs? We know the Chinese have been trying to target parts of the U.S. that make things that Chinese purchase, but from people who have supported Donald Trump. Why would the Trump administration target handbags, refrigerators, rain jackets, dog leashes?
Well, this is a really interesting one because this is a bit of a sea change that we've seen from previous lists, from the past list that the Trump administration put out that actually came into force last week, because that really targeted more what we call intermediate products, components that are used by businesses. And now we're seeing them look at consumer goods. And this is something that will directly impact U.S. consumers. This is a 10% tariff on $200 billion worth of U.S. goods. As you said, baseball gloves, air conditioning units, rain jackets, all kind of things. And this is a balancing act for the administration, because so far they've really tried to shield the U.S. consumer by targeting these products that go directly to businesses. But I think this is a function now of just how much of U.S. imports from China they are now targeting. If you take the $200 billion, add it to the $50 billion that's already been announced, that's about half. So it's very difficult at that point to shield the U.S. consumer. And I think that was a telling reaction, Robin, today from the National Retail Federation. They said this was a reckless strategy and it would boomerang back and hit the U.S. consumer and worker.
And this is days after, it's sort of a round, you know, it's sort of rounds of fire back and forth between China and the U.S. We had other tariffs that took effect against China worth $34 billion. But so, you know, where, if this is a trade war, where are we in this war? Do we see a strategy?
Well, the administration's strategy is to try and get other countries to lower trade barriers. That's what we've heard from multiple U.S. Officials over the past couple of months. And in the case of China, to get it to change its ways, to open up its markets and to end abuse of intellectual property, as well as, of course, to try and bring down that trade deficit. The report card, Robin, on that so far is not good. Obviously, we haven't seen any lowering of trade barriers. We've seen quite the opposite when it comes to the retaliatory tariffs that have now come in, not only from China, but from the likes of the EU, Canada, Mexico. So this is the opposite of what the Trump administration wanted to do. And in terms of China, they were at the negotiating table. You'll remember it was just a couple of months ago we heard from Steven Mnuchin, who had been in China, who said, you know, the trade war is on hold. Now we hear from administration officials last night that the negotiations with China are pretty much dead in the water. One administration official told us that the Chinese continue to insist the problems we've identified are not real problems. So there's a major kind of dissonance now between the two sides. And I think that's one of the things that has tipped the markets a little bit into these trade war nerves again today.
Well, what about China? Can they really hold out on soy? We know they enacted that huge 25% tariff on American soybeans. They love soybeans. They, you know, much of the sales from the U.S. goes to China. Are the Chinese really going to move away from American soy, or are they just going to pay more?
Well, I think for the moment they're either going to just pay more or they're going to look for other sources. Brazil is another big exporter of soybeans. But I think when it comes to levers that China can pull on the U.S., this is a really interesting kind of inflection point that we find ourselves at right now, because they've always said we're going to retaliate in kind. They can't retaliate in kind this time because the U.S. is threatening 200 billions of goods coming from China. China's going to run out of American goods to tariff. The U.S. only exported $130 billion worth of goods to China last year. So now we're looking at either, you know, some kind of non-tariff barriers. Are they going to target services? Are they going to make it more difficult for U.S. companies in China? You know, companies like Apple have a lot of business there. Starbucks, the statistic is they open another store every 15 hours in China. Or will China now go the other way? Will they claim the moral high ground here and continue to make more moves to open up their markets in ways that suit them? I think this is a bit of a crossroads in this trade dispute that we find ourselves at.
And so we wait to see which exit we will take. Claire Sebastian, correspondent for CNN Money, thank you.
Thank you very much.
There's a new documentary about one of the best-selling music artists of all time, Whitney Houston. Some of her number one hits. She had 11. But behind the scenes, as is often the case, things were not pretty. A new documentary called Whitney explores that side of Houston's life, which was cut short when she died of an accidental drowning involving drugs in a hotel bathtub at age 48. Kevin MacDonald is the director of Whitney. He joins us from London. And Kevin MacDonald, Whitney Houston has this glamorous image. She was the daughter of singer Sissy Houston, but her life was anything but glamorous.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that you would imagine having your cousin be Dionne Warwick, who was a huge star, obviously, in the 60s and the 70s, and your mother being one of the greatest backing singers of all time, who sang with everyone from Van Morrison to Elvis to Aretha Franklin, that she would grow up in a very glamorous circumstances. But that's not really the case. She grew up in a very rough part of New York to begin with, and they moved to a slightly more salubrious area called East Orange, which was a kind of racially mixed, I guess, lower middle class suburb. But throughout her early years, she suffered a lot from racially motivated bullying, really effectively for not being black enough. And her mother and her sister-in-law recount in the documentary how she would be run home by all these kids from school who would be taunting her for dressing like a little white girl.
Right.
And that kind of theme of being a kind of outsider, even within your own racial group, was something I think that haunted her whole life.
But she had success very early. She got a record contract when she was, what, 19 years old?
I think that's right. Yeah, I think she was groomed for stardom by her mother, and to a lesser extent, her father. Her mother, as I said, had been this hugely successful background singer, but she had wanted to be a star in her own right, be a solo artist. But she was never able to break through. She released three or four albums. None of them really worked. And she saw in Whitney somebody who could have the success that she didn't. And so she was, I wouldn't say it goes so far as saying a creation of her mother, but her mother was a Svengali in a way.
And she created this image, Whitney Houston did, of being kind of a pop princess. But her brothers, Michael and Gary, were very honest in your documentary about the fact that they were using drugs when they toured with her, and she was too.
Yeah, I mean, I think they came from a part of New York which was hit pretty heavily by the crack cocaine epidemic. People used drugs all around them. And Whitney, in the film, you see a family friend of theirs called Keith Kelly, who recounts when he first gave Whitney cocaine when she was 16. And other people, you know, not always in the film, but other people told me that, you know, she was regularly using by the time she was 17, 18. And so even at the point where she was America's sweetheart, when she was this, you know, seemingly beautiful, innocent, fresh-faced singer, and was the kind of girl that, you know, your mum maybe thought that you should go out with, she was actually using drugs very, very heavily. And that just got worse and worse through mm-hmm. the 90s and through the 2000s, as people are probably aware.
We have to talk about Whitney Houston's sexuality. One of the people you talked to referred to her as fluid. And many in the film talk about her relationship with Robin Crawford, who was her closest companion during her early success. How would you describe her sexuality?
Well, it's obviously presumptuous in some ways to talk about somebody's sexuality who's not here to describe
right.
it themselves.
Right.
But from what I can understand, and obviously I haven't spoken to Robin Crawford. She's very much alive. She didn't want to take part in the film. My feeling is that, you know, Whitney loved who she loved. You know, she didn't differentiate whether you were male or female. It was just if she found herself attracted to you, then she may fall in love with you. But having said that, I don't know of any other documented cases of lesbian relationships that she had other than the one with Robin Crawford, which went on for a number of years and I think was a kind of a key relationship for her before she famously married Bobby Brown, the R&B singer.
The most disturbing revelation in your documentary is that Whitney Houston and her brother Gary were molested by their cousin, Dee Dee Warwick. That's the sister of Dionne Warwick. Dee Dee Warwick, also a singer. How sure are you of that? Or is it just hearsay?
Well, I'm pretty sure. I began to suspect that there was some trauma, some abuse in Whitney's background quite early on, just from various things that Whitney said and from the way she behaved. It seemed to line up with some of the things that I knew about the effects of childhood trauma. And then when I was talking to Gary, her brother, about his own addiction, he struggled with drug addiction his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying to him, what is it with you that you feel, what is the thing underpinning this addiction that makes it hard for you to quit? And he said, well, the biggest thing is that I was abused by a female cousin when I was a boy. And it turned out to be Dee Dee Warwick. So I then went on to talk to Whitney's sister-in-law and to her personal assistant, Mary Jones, about this. And they both said, yes, Whitney had talked to them about it. And the assistant went into some detail about the conversations that she had had with Whitney about it. Now, I think that I don't see any reason why Gary Houston would lie about his own experience mm-hmm. of being abused. That would seem quite a far-fetched thing to imagine that somebody would make that up. Plus, knowing Pat Houston and knowing Mary Jones, the assistant, these are very upstanding women. Why on earth would they make that up? I think that I might have thought twice about including the accusation and the name of the perpetrator if it had only been her hearsay. But because I had somebody who was Whitney's brother, Gary Houston, actually saying to me, this happened to me and this is who did it, that felt like that would stand up in a court of law as a pretty convincing piece of evidence.
And Dee Dee Warwick, by the way, is no longer alive.
She is no longer alive. She died, I think, in around 2008.
But Dionne Warwick is. Has she talked to you about this?
No, I did talk to Dionne prior to knowing about this. I did an interview with her, which I didn't use in the film just because mm-hmm. it didn't have a place really in the film. And I subsequently have not spoken to her. I've left that to the family. It's a family matter, I think, for them to discuss internally. My understanding is that she's obviously not happy with this information coming out. But the rest of the family are very much supporting the film and supporting the kind of understanding that it gives not mm-hmm. just the world, but them as a family of what was really underlying Whitney's tragic life.
Well, one of the most touching clips you have in the film is Whitney Houston singing to her daughter, Bobby Christina, on stage. Here it is.
Bobby, 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 my baby, my little girl, oh, she inspires me, and she giving me joy, 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 joy.
She inspires me. She's giving me joy. But, you know, the tale that you tell is one of a mother who basically ended up neglecting her daughter, bringing her on tour with her maybe, but not spending a lot of time thinking about her.
Yeah, I don't know if she didn't spend a lot of time thinking about her. But, yes, it's the hard thing to It's the hard thing to understand about Whitney. When you're trying to make a film, you're trying to find a way to love your subject, and you want your audience to love your subject. But while making this movie, there was always one point where I found that my sympathy and my compassion failed, and that was when looking at the sequences to do with her daughter. And there's no doubt that she was not a great mother. She was a bad mother, probably. I would go so far as to say. And I think that led directly to her daughter's early demise. Her daughter died 2 years after right. Whitney did, and under spookily strange circumstances, drowning or half drowning in a bathtub while under the influence of drugs. So yeah, that's a real struggle, but it's part of what makes Whitney so complex and interesting. And the thing I found with this film, unlike anything else I've ever done, is that people want to debate and discuss it. There are no hard and fast answers, but Whitney's life story seems to be one that is so resonant for people. It's a pure tragedy in the Greek or the Shakespearean sense. It's about somebody who had it all, who had beauty, who had incredible talent, talent without compare, success, everything, and somehow through the character flaws or the experiences of her childhood, managed to throw it all away and ended up in an almost unbearably sad situation.
That's Kevin MacDonald, who is the director of the new documentary Whitney, about the life of singer Whitney Houston. It's in theaters now. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And the film also features one of Houston's proudest moments, singing the national anthem during the 1991 Super Bowl. She only heard that version one time before she performed it. You can watch it and get more information on the documentary at hereandnow.org.
So today, England is playing Croatia in the World Cup semifinals in Russia. The winner meets France in Sunday's grand finale. England's only World Cup title came way back in 1966. Croatia's never won one, so lots of hungry players and fans. The BBC's Simon Jones is in London. Simon, is that about right?
Well, we're very, very excited and I'll have to admit, very, very nervous. That's not just me, but I think the entire nation here. If you're an England football fan or soccer, as you might say, Robin, there have been many, many years of hurt. Since the 1966 World Cup win, the trophy cupboard has been absolutely bare. But that could all change with this big game against Croatia in Moscow, England's first World Cup semi-finals in 28 years. And back in 1990, Croatia didn't even exist as a country. And what makes this so extraordinary is no one really expected this to happen. It's an inexperienced squad, it's an inexperienced manager, and they've been winning. And so the country has fallen in love with them.
That's a key. Make them have no experience. Here's a clip from a video on the Sun newspaper website. It's the English coach, Gareth Southgate. Let's listen.
We have the chance to affect something bigger than ourselves. We're a team with our diversity that represent modern England. In England, we've spent a bit of time being a bit lost as to what our modern identity is. And I think as a team, we represent that modern identity.
They talk a little bit more about that because you have a Muslim mayor of London. You also have recent attacks in Manchester and London. When some people who are really outside of the sport think of English fans, they might think of some of the hooligans who weren't even allowed to travel to Russia. So what is he saying is about what this new reality might be?
I think he's talking about unity, alluding to Brexit, Britain deciding to leave the European Union and how that has divided the country. But I think what Gareth Southgate is saying as manager is sport, he says, has the power to unite. And he says, over in Moscow, they can feel the energy from home. And that energy is being seen in so many ways here. For example, today has been nicknamed Waistcoat Wednesday. Oh. And you might ask why. But
why?
We're talking about Gareth Southgate, the England manager, and he is famed for wearing his waistcoat. So many people have adopted wearing waistcoats.
Simon, I just have to jump in to say, for Americans listening, that he's not wearing the thing that you sometimes see along paneling, the waistcoating. He's wearing like a vest.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. His sartorial elegance. He's not wearing paneling. He's wearing something that makes you look a bit smart. You often wear them with suits. And as well as dress sense, we've also been going crazy for a song called Three Lions. I don't know whether you've ever heard it, but the refrain of that is football's coming home. Everyone's singing it. And even Prince Harry was asked today, is football coming home? And he said, most definitely.
As you speak, we are typing away to get it for our listeners, the BBC's Simon Jones in London. Simon, we have to say to our Croatian listeners, we applaud and root for them as well, but good luck.
Many thanks. And can I just say one thing? I'm not biased, but come on, England.
One of the most powerful men in Washington is the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell. A Republican of Kentucky, McConnell has drawn ire not only from Democrats, but from Republicans who see him as the consummate Washington insider, although he's been very successful at achieving Republican goals. We're going to take a few minutes now for a close look at McConnell with Paul Kane, senior congressional correspondent and columnist for The Washington Post. Paul, take us back. Who is Mitch McConnell? How did he get involved in politics and why?
So Mitch McConnell grew up as a son of the South in a small family, only child. He had polio, and his father was off in fighting World War II, and his mother brought him to the Roosevelt compound in Warm Springs, Georgia, where he, you know, learned how to overcome polio. It was sort of the beginnings of what he would call the long game. And as a polio survivor, he wasn't a great athlete. He wasn't completely disabled. And basically at a really early age in high school, he had the political bug. He knew back then that he wasn't the most popular kid, and he developed what would be something, a hallmark that would stay with him well into his 70s. It was all about tactics. He won his high school class presidency not by making the biggest promises or having the best vision for what would happen to the school. He just knew exactly how to campaign better than anybody else and put together a campaign in which he went around to all the most popular cheerleaders and all the most popular jocks in the high school and got them to endorse him. And then he made up these endorsement sheets, almost like a whip card that you'd see in the Senate today. And it just had a list of all the popular people endorsing Mitch McConnell. And he walked around slipping these inside the locker of people. It was a really big high school back then, from grades 7 through 12, he once told me. So the 7th, 8th, and 9th graders really didn't know any of the upperclassmen. But they got these cards that said, you know, captain of the football team endorses Mitch McConnell for class president. And boom, who won class president? Mitch McConnell.
So he figured out how to win elections. What was it that drove him when it comes to issues?
Issues were always a bit flexible early in McConnell's political career. By the time he got to the University of Louisville and became an intern in the Senate, he was interning for John Sherman Cooper, who was a moderate Republican who worked closely with President Kennedy, who fought very much on the side of the Civil Rights Act. So McConnell's early instincts were actually fairly moderate by today's standards on all of sort of the hot button issues when it came to things like civil rights and abortion. Eventually in 1969-70, he comes to the Senate working for a Republican senator named Marlo Cook. Cook was the Judiciary Committee Republican, and Cook was also given the sort of tasked by the Nixon White House as being the main supporter of his Supreme Court nominees. And those two were very controversial and Democrats put up a huge fight and eventually defeated both of them. And it was a sort of searing moment in McConnell's life. He ends up writing a University of Kentucky Law Review article all about how we shouldn't be looking at too much of the politics of these nominees. It's a viewpoint that back in 2016, when McConnell had basically put a blanket hold on Merrick Garland,
right,
for very political reasons, but those were his views back then. He then ends up in the Nixon Justice Department in a period of life that, I'll be honest, he has kind of washed it out of his biography. He then, by about 1975, heads back to Louisville full-time and decides it's time to get into politics.
Hmm.
And he won his first big race in 1977.
And then he got to the Senate when?
He gets to the Senate in 1984 on the coattails of Ronald Reagan, running against an incumbent Democrat, targeting the incumbent Democratic senator as sort of aloof, nowhere to be found, on junkets, and he brought out bloodhounds. His ad maker brought out bloodhounds and were sort of running around Kentucky in this famous ad searching for the incumbent senator. And that helped propel McConnell to what was considered an upset win then, because, you know, the South had still not fully transformed at the Senate, congressional, local level. So he was part of sort of a minority of Republicans from the South at that point in 1984.
One of the issues that he's been very consistent on over the years is campaign spending,
yes,
limits. He has long opposed legislation on that. Here he is speaking out against a constitutional amendment proposed in 2014, which would have allowed Congress and states to set limits on raising and spending in campaigns.
But the political nature of this exercise should not obscure how shockingly bad this proposal is. This is embarrassingly bad to be advocating for the first time in our history that we amend the First Amendment to restrict the rights of citizens to speak.
Why is this issue so important to him?
There are only a few real core issues that have stuck with him, and this is one of them. He believes that he is a proud defender of the First Amendment. He believes that political speech is unlimited, completely protected, and anybody at any price should be allowed to speak it. And it, you know, rubs people the wrong way because you end up having a corporation or a super rich person who can dwarf what the
right
average person can spend for his or her political speech.
McConnell is very opposed to term limits for lawmakers as well.
Yes. And again, I think he would believe that that fits into this sort of same vein of consistency. If in a perfect world of free speech, anybody can say anything they want about a senator within the law, and you either vote him out or you vote him back in,
right,
and that the voters there are the ultimate check on term limits.
One of the things that Mitch McConnell got a lot of attention for in the early years of President Obama's first term was that he said, and he was minority leader in the Senate at the time, he told the conservative magazine, The National Review, that the single most important thing that he wanted to achieve is for President Obama to be a one-term president. Later, he clarified his position to the right-wing Heritage Foundation. Let's listen.
Over the past week, some have said it was indelicate of me to suggest that our top political priority over the next 2 years should be to deny President Obama a second term. But the fact is, if our primary legislative goals are to repeal and replace the health spending bill, to end the bailouts, cut spending, and shrink the size and scope of government, the only way to do all of those things is to put someone in the White House who won't veto any of these things.
While McConnell may not have succeeded in that goal of keeping Obama to one term, how did his strategy of opposition to President Obama work out for him and the Republican Party?
Very early on, he looked around and they had only 40 senators. And he made this political calculus that if he could hold all 40 of his Republican men and women together, that would put all the pressure on the Democrats to get all 60 of their votes. And it then makes every single Senate Democrat the deciding vote on a big issue. And that is exactly how it played out on what Republicans derisively call Obamacare. You know, and Democrats and Harry Reid in particular, the majority leader at the time, thought this was a viciously cynical strategy, but it made the law almost delegitimized as a purely partisan exercise, passed by 60 Democrats and opposed by 40 Republicans. And that was essentially the political goal, was to put all the heat on Democrats and then make almost all of their legislation feel as if it was a Democratic-only exercise, and so that if the public had recoiled at anything, they would be recoiling at the Democrats. And that's pretty much how the 2010 midterm elections unfolded. Mm-hmm. Unemployment was up around 10% for most of 2010, and the public just got angrier and angrier. And the backlash snapped into effect when Republicans swept in and won a huge House majority and picked up almost 6 seats in the Senate, not quite getting to the majority, but setting the stage for Republicans to eventually win back the majority in the Senate.
That's Paul Kane of The Washington Post. Tomorrow, we'll continue our conversation and hear what McConnell did with the Senate majority and how he's reshaped the Supreme Court.
Our next story is about dishes, those great old dishes at the diner or maybe a Midwest pie place, ceramic, solid, beige, shiny. From 1930 to 1968, TEPCO, which is short for the Technical Porcelain and Chinaware Company, made dishes like these out of their factory in El Cerrito, California, and they do seem ordinary, but they're very meaningful to a small band of collectors from all over California, maybe you. Ariel Plotnick from member station KQED takes us to meet some of them.
A few months ago, I sat outside of a cafe in El Cerrito with Sandy Genzer-Mack. She talked about the moment she and her husband found what they'd been looking for years.
We always go antiquing wherever we go. And we went to this antique store, and way down low in a cabinet where you could hardly see were two doggy diner mugs. We were quivering. We were so excited.
These aren't just any mugs. They're TEPCO mugs, and at one time, they were in restaurants all over the Bay Area. Sandy and Lynn have an outdoor shed filled with TEPCO dishes. They had a newsletter called the TEPCO Tribune, and they started a fan club.
And when we created the TEPCO Collectors Club, I was the main dish.
I'm Lynn Mack, and as part of the TEPCO Club, I was the side dish.
Sandy and Lynn, the main dish and the side dish. We flipped through a binder full of images from the original TEPCO catalog. Every plate ever made in every pattern. Some plates sport wild decorations. Bamboo leaves, wagon wheels, flowers, and pagodas. The plates also have wild names.
Concord, Flame, Melody, Mohawk, Monarch, Pixie, Reef.
And the dishes are beautiful in a kind of ugly way.
I don't know. It's got dings and scratches and knots. And the quality is very bad. And I don't know. We love it.
The factory was founded in 1930 by Italian immigrant John Pagliaro. He started out making porcelain kitchen appliances, toilets, and sinks. And then realized he could do a lot more business by selling everyday items like plates and cups. The factory produced tens of thousands of pieces of pottery every day, all handmade. TEPCO was El Cerrito's biggest employer.
Oval platters and bowls were thrown on eccentric jiggers.
A relative of John Pagliaro made a documentary of found footage from the TEPCO factory. Workers mix and pour porcelain into dish molds.
Decorators tossed the china into a tub of water, and when the tissue soaked free, it left the design clearly registered. Then the ware was ready for the glaze dippers.
Back then, TEPCO dishes were everywhere. They were at restaurants, country clubs, and even shipyards. The Army and Navy used full sets of TEPCO in their mess halls and on their ships. El Cerrito mothers, the story goes, used to tell their kids to bike down to the TEPCO factory to pick up an extra table setting. The factory was going strong until one day in 1968 when it was destroyed by a kiln fire. Now, all that's left of the factory is a place affectionately known as TEPCO Beach. The factory used to drive their broken plates right here to Point Isabel in nearby Richmond. Multicolored TEPCO shards are piled in a thick layer on top of the sand, mixed with dried seaweed. Walk on the beach and you hear the crunch of porcelain underneath your feet. Crouch down and you can find special treasures, patterned pieces, and handles broken off from teacups. Remember Lynn Mack, the self-proclaimed side dish of the Collectors Club? It's just Lynn and me at the beach today. His wife Sandy died recently, unexpectedly. Without her, TEPCO isn't that fun anymore.
You know, I look at some of the collection and it's lost some of its luster, you know, because it's something we did together and now I can't even look at some of it.
People with a passion for TEPCO are getting harder and harder to find. It's even more difficult to find people who remember life at the factory. With Sandy gone, Lynn's big TEPCO collection really feels like the last monument to the factory.
What are we going to do with all this stuff? I know that these things are important to me. They're probably not going to be important to somebody else when I'm gone.
But it's important to me. I've started collecting TEPCO now. You can find the dishes pretty easily at flea markets all around California. But it's more fun to see them in use, in the wild. Every so often, I sit down to eat at a diner and think I see a TEPCO plate. I flip it over to check if it has the green TEPCO stamp on the back. It rarely does. But I'll keep flipping dishes over, because one day I might find a TEPCO plate. For Here and Now, I'm Arielle Plotnick.
Do Jeremy and I sound different?
I don't think people would be able to tell, but there is something different today. We're in a new studio.
Woo!
We have been working on this for quite some time, and we are now in Studio 5.
And when we say we mean Carl Volker and his team and James Trout and his team. Congratulations, guys. It's really a lovely place to work, and thanks to our listeners.
And we haven't had any major technical malfunctions yet today.
Well, soon it will be coming. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.